Underworld, Disc 17.
In the 3 days she was there, to small and passing purpose, so it wasn't supposed to matter what she saw and heard. But at some point in the 3 days, someone mentioned the Watts Towers. And Clara thought she probably ought to see this place, because she'd known about the towers for years, and thought maybe if there's time, and then forgot about it. At another point, she got a call from New York. And who was it? Someone eager to read reviews of AC's show. The first to appear. And they were bad. They were stinging and grim. And Clara called a few people who said word around town was even worse. They spoke with controlled excitement, that tone of breathy documentary where you code your pleasure to the formal pauses. They waited for her to respond in kind. This made her feel sleazy as hell. They waited for her to rejoice in kind, on cue, with due observance of the protocols. That was the next to last day. On the last day, she went to see the Watts Towers. Miles dropped her off and said he'd come by an hour later. She had no idea. She didn't know a thing so rucked in the vernacular could have such an epic quality. All she knew about the towers was that the man worked alone, an immigrant, for many years, a sort of unimaginable number of years, and used whatever objects he could forage and scrounge. She went around touching things, rubbing her palms over the bright surfaces. She loved the patterns made by jute doormats pressed in cement. She loved the crushed green glass and the bottle bottoms that knobbed an archway. And one of the taller towers with its tracery of whirling atoms. And the south wall candied with pebbles and mussel shells. She didn't know what this was exactly. It was an amusement park, a temple complex. And she didn't know what else. A deli bazaar, an Italian street feast, maybe. A place riddled with epiphanies, that's what it was. Cats passed through. They were everywhere, asleep in the sun, or trying to mooch a knuckle rub. Strays from the hot streets, ghetto cats. And she felt a kind of static in her body, seeing columns inlaid with broken glass, shards of discarded mirrors, and the crazy quilt tiles, and the arc he'd shaped over the front gate with cans of Canada Dry. She felt a static, a depth of spirit. She felt delectation that took the form of near helplessness. Like laughing helplessly as a girl, collapsing against the shoulder of your best friend. She was weak with sensation, weak with seeing and feeling. She touched and pressed. She looked up through the struts of the tallest tower. Such splendid independence this man was gifted with, or likely fought for. And now she wanted to leave. She didn't need to stay any longer. An hour was too long. And she stood by the entrance, buzzing, and waited for Miles to arrive. That night, she got on the phone and tried to find AC. She called around for an hour, waking people up. And Miles came in, dragging, and pulled off his boots where he stood, a seamless swipe of the hand, repeated. She said, "Look, your socks are the color of the rug. That must mean it's time to leave." He told her about his afternoon, which was spent around a pool drained of water. Speaking of which, there was a guy there who described how he'd faked his own suicide by drowning and managed to effect a clean disappearance. "You're talking a mile a minute," she said. "And there's Yankel saying, the Israeli with the bankroll, 'Some people fake their death. I'm faking my life.'" She called New York again and found out AC had gone somewhere, or just didn't want to talk. Miles wanted to talk. Miles was beat. He was dragging, but also amped up, jangled by caffeine and freeway traffic, and whatever else he was inhaling in the way of controlled substances. 3 days of whatever else on the fringes of the business. They were in a borrowed apartment, and he had to get up early to go to normal. And there was a space between his weariness and his sparky nerve ends, and they filled it persuasively with sex. They did it and did it, and talked and did it. They had a thumping time. Or she did. She wasn't sure what he was having. He was intense and a little feverish, and had his indigenous common cold. And when he talked, it was on a polyphonic plane, steep and desperate. And when he fucked, it was strong and aloof. Not aloof, but rootless. A kind of any-fuck, in the sense that there was nothing outside the act. They lived for the strokes, for the nasal drone. And finally he slept, and then she did. And they barely made their flights in the morning. From the air, what was it like? The vast, swept west, basin and range. You could almost detect the mineral content, the Badland shale. It was the kind of immense and unsparing beauty that left you slightly subdued because you didn't know the natural language, the names of formations and mountain folds. And her father, with his Hopi scout, Hopi or Navajo, his viewmaster slides of a head-banded scout at the edge of a canyon, sitting in the kitchen clicking his slides through the handheld device. He specialized in slides of the Great West. He called it the Great West, and it was. It is. Look at it. His 3D slides of the trail ride down the canyon on muleback. Or the canyon dons the velvety cloak of twilight. And that's exactly what it did. His completely unreachable West. And he sat in the kitchen because the light was better there. She didn't know the West, and she'd never flown above it in weather so clear. It looked young and untouched. It had the strangeness of worlds we'd never seen. It was not ours from up here. It was too flowingly new and strange. We hadn't settled it yet. Clara remembered who she was. She pulled away from the window, and she was a sculptor. Although she didn't always believe it. An artist. She believed them sometimes when they said she wasn't. She thought of her work, the skewed meter of putty and junk, the crambo clink. She thought of rust rot and wadded cotton batting. She wanted to feel the urge to work again. She wanted to be rushing out of the airport to take a taxi home. She needed to feel that thing begin to happen, suddenly, that faith-worthy feeling, that newness, a freshet of life behind the eyes. She called around looking for Racy and reached her a few days later. She was bitter and tight and didn't want to talk. But Clara talked to her. She was good at this. She had talked like this to Teresa 1,000 times, the daughter determined to be unhappy. They had dinner that night and talked some more. Clara was in control. She cajoled and encouraged. She was good at this. She was eager to help, and she was helping. The waiter stood there reciting the specials. There was a fire down the street, or a false alarm, and an amplified voice erupted from one of the trucks, absorbing everything around it. And the days got darker earlier, and the streets began to acquire a medieval texture with strange, draped women, scarfed like Tuaregs, living in junked cars, watchful and silent, and the ones who danced in subways for loose coins. And the ones with their own radio programs that you didn't need a radio to listen to because they followed you down the street in the endless, inspired catastrophe of New York. After a while, some people got up and walked around. They didn't leave. Almost nobody left. The footage kept repeating, and they walked around. They stirred from their corners and visited the other rooms, or stood in front of the TV wall. They were like tourists walking through the rooms of some small private collection, the Zapruder Museum, one item on permanent display, the 20-some-odd seconds of a home movie, and it runs continuously. It ran continuously. Men who carried the power of the state, the film muddied by sun glint, riding in a car with their confident wives, all the jostled quality of birthday footage. Or they stayed on the floor and passed a joint, and just kept looking in an acquired sort of awe. Here comes the car, here comes the shot. And it was amazing that there were forces in the culture that could out-imagine them, make their druggiest terrors seem futile and cheap. The footage ran at normal speed on some sets, slow motion on others. And the car moved down Elm Street and past the freeway sign, and the head dipped out of the frame and reappeared, and the shot was unexpected. Different phases of the sequence showed on different screens, and the spectator's eye could jump from Zapruder 239 back to 185, and down to the headshot, and over to the opening frames. And on the TV wall, the sets and frames were geared to patterns. The TV wall was a kind of game board of diagonals and verticals, and so on, interlocking tarots of elemental fate, or synchronous footage running in an X pattern. And whatever the mathematics of the wall, there were 100 images running at once. Here comes the car, here comes the shot. And even though it wasn't part of the footage, Clara was sure there was a hurt sign on top of the book depository. She'd seen it in photographs, forgotten about it until now, and thought it was another passing strangeness, however minor, a rent-a-car sign brooding over the motorcade. A man and woman stood in a closet with the door open, seemingly stoned and not especially noticeable, remotely making out. Clara happened to glimpse them when she went by. She knew she'd hear from Miles at dinner about the secret manipulation of history, or attempts at such, or how the experts couldn't seem to produce a clear print of the movie, or whatever. But the movie, in fact, was powerfully open. It was glary and artless and completely steeped in being what it was, in being film. It carried a kind of inner life, something unconnected to the things we call phenomena. The footage seemed to advance some argument about the nature of film itself. The progress of the car down Elm Street, the movement of the film through the camera body, some shareable darkness. This was a death that seemed to rise from the steamy debris of the deep mind. It came from some night of the mind. There was some trick of film emulsion that showed the ghost of consciousness. Or so she thought to wonder. She thought to wonder if this home movie was some crude, living likeness of the mind's own technology, the sort of death plot that runs in the mind, because it seemed so familiar, the footage did. It seemed a thing we might see, not see but know, a model of the nights when we are intimate with our own dying. Someone passed her a joint. She passed it back. On a large console, the screen was split four ways, and the headshot ran in every sector, and "It's outside language," Miles said, which was his way of saying far out, or too much, or the other things they used to say. And here was an event that took place at the beginning of the 60s, seen belatedly, that now marked the conceptual end, carrying all the delirium that floated through the age. And people stood around and talked. A man and woman made out in a closet with the door open, remotely. And the pot fumes grew stronger. And people said, "Let's go eat," or whatever people say when a thing begins to be over. It ran continuously. A man in his 40s in a suit and tie. And all the sets were showing slow motion now, riding in a car with his confident wife. And the footage took on a sense of elegy, running ever slower, running down. A sense of greatness, really. The car's regal gleam and the murder of some figure out of dimmest lore. A greatness, a kingliness. The terrible mist of tissue and skull, so massively slow. On Elm Street. And they got something to eat and went to the loft, where they played cards for a couple of hours and did not talk about Zapruder. She married Carlo Strasser in his Park Avenue apartment, before a justice of the peace and 25 friends of the couple. Carlo's daughter was there, the youngest of his three children, a beautiful spindly girl, 15, who lived with her mother in Brussels. It was one of those autumn days in New York, and Clara's daughter also appeared, about half an hour late, but lively and bright, completely unmorose. She embraced people left and right and danced after the ceremony with Jack Marshall. It was one of those taut autumn days. The bride wore an old brocade vest that had once been her mother's, and someone's before that, a second cousin or great aunt, and maybe someone's before that, before America. People ate wherever they found a space, standing up or sitting primly in hall chairs, and the dancing didn't last long. It wasn't meant to be a drawn-out affair. When the guests were gone, they decided to take a walk, the bride and groom and their daughters. And after a night of stiff winds, the air was rinsed clean, and the light was so precise that distances in the park seemed diminished. Clouds began to build, fair-weather cumulus, high-prowed and drifting. It was one of those days in Central Park when there's a distilled sense of perception, a spareness, every line firm and unredundant. And the leaves were beginning to turn, the dogwoods and sumacs, and nothing was wasted or went unseen. How nice to be a family again, even if fleeting and incomplete, with parceled-out children and children on tight schedules, and who knows when they'll all see each other next. Carlo's daughter spoke a clipped, efficient English. She stuck to her father's side and followed his wagging hand to particular vistas. They could look over the treetops to the buildings on Fifth Avenue, the unbroken taupe facade, and then to the mansards and temple tops at the western edge of the park. And Clara imagined the whistling doormen, the taxis hot-footing past. She loved the showy yellow coats of New York cabs. It was one of those days of light and scale when everything you see has the full breadth of intention. She held Teresa's hand and talked about visits here and there, and they made promises and resolutions. They made mental notes. And how nice, how strange to be doubly paired like this, husband and wife, mother and daughter. And she saw that Carlo walked with a slight limp and was amused to think she'd never noticed. Felt free to be amused. Felt, what the hell? It's only marriage. They walked behind a man with a wolfhound, a dog as grand as any in a vodka ad. Clara laughed for no reason. Maybe she laughed for no reason, and maybe because she'd noticed her husband had a limp. The others thought she was laughing in relief, laughing in the spirit of a swirling day, and it made them all smile benignly. They thought she was laughing in the aftermath of checking on planes that were late and hearing complaints from the caterer and finding the right receptacles for all the goddamn flowers. And finally just unwinding on a walk, they thought, laughing in ragged relief. They thought they knew the mystery of living in her skin. Part 5. Better Things for Better Living Through Chemistry. Selected Fragments, Public and Private, in the 1950s and 1960s. Chapter 1. November 3rd, 1952. You looked at the hills, and they were rolling hills that made you wonder who you were and how you got here. The hills had no more connection to your life than a calendar with a picture of hills, old rolling hills set above a river, fixed to some kitchen wall. I sensed the river was out there somewhere, a briskness in the wind, and I took deep breaths because I was upstate, and it was supposed to be healthy here. Stottsburg was 75 miles from home, farther than I'd ever been, and I got settled in the dorm and took classes for a high school certificate. And never missed an afternoon in the old barn where the makeshift gym was located, a boxing ring at one end and a backboard at the other. You commit your crimes in the city, and they send you upstate to take deep breaths and get a perspective on your life. I played basketball with members of a street gang named the Alhambras after a movie theater in Harlem. They were doing nigger time, they said. They'd come up through Youth House and a number of reformatories, raised on the felony alphabet. And we pounded up and down the floor in that dusty gym, working off the effects of our transgressions. We were all juvies, under 18. I was an E-felony. Criminally negligent homicide, reduced from a charge of manslaughter in the second degree. And we played game after game of half-court. Going all out and taking deep and healthy breaths and having a tussle or two. You could fight a guy here and then forget it, leave it on the court or in the ring, because you'd already mind-whipped yourself repeatedly for what you'd done out there on the streets, whatever misfit thing of rage or bleakness or stupendous aberration. And maybe you'd reached an early maturity on the subject of running a grudge, how important it is to be selective. When I entered correction, I wanted things to make sense. I kept my bed neat, corners squared, and stacked my clothes sensibly in my cubicle. The minute I entered correction, I was a convert to the system. I went out on work crews that did road repair, and I was the eagerest hand, giving myself up to the rote motions of breaking asphalt, leaky-eyed and sneezing in the ragweed brush. I believed in the stern logic of correction. I did my study assignments every night, and pounded the floor and pounded the boards in the old gym. Good riddance to bad beginnings. Blood beginnings. And I was ready for this, hammering hard surfaces on some country road in the julepy haze of a midsummer day, feeling the dead soul slowly drain out of me, the sedimentary stuff of who I was gone in the dancing air of insects and pollen. The hills took on color in the fall, and they had about as much meaning in your life as a poem on a calendar, four lines about rolling hills in Ronald Coleman English. At Stottsburg, I heard many stories about Doogie, which was one of the 99 names of heroin. But I didn't tell them my own weak-kneed story about how I was scared of needles and drugs. At Stottsburg, they had a psychologist who wanted me to talk about the shooting. She thought it was the way to my salvation. I told her, "No, man, forget it. Let's talk about the weather." I gave her nothing she could use on my behalf. I didn't want sweetheart treatment. I was here to do time, 1.5 to 3, and all I wanted from the system was method and regularity. When the kitchen caught fire, I was disappointed. I took it personally. I didn't understand how a well-trained staff could allow this to happen. When 3 kids went out the gate in the rear of a bakery truck, 15-year-olds, junior alley boys, as the Alhambras were sometimes called, I thought it was a tremendous, a dereliction. A collapse, bunched in the back of a Silver Cup truck. I was shocked at the level of neglect. In the gym that day, we played half-court with our customary combat skills, hacking the shooter, wheeling off the boards with elbows jutting. But the intensity wasn't there, and the game stopped cold a couple of times so the players could talk about the escape. They cracked jokes and bent over laughing, but I thought the joke was on us. We weren't worth much if the system designed to contain us kept breaking down. All that winter I shoveled snow and read books. The lines of print, the alphabetic characters, the strokes of the shovel when I cleared a walk, the linear arrangement of words on a page, the shovel strokes, the rote exercises in school texts, the novels I read, the dictionaries I found in the tiny library, the nature and shape of books, the routine of shovel strokes in deep snow. This was how I began to build an individual. But before the snows came and the ground hardened, they put in the golf course. Miniature golf. Novelty golf. They unloaded the equipment in a field near the mess hall on a sweet and clear November day. Plywood castles and ramps. Enough junk for 9 holes. Little water wheels and bridges and whatnot. I watched it all take shape with an odd kind of disbelief. I felt tricked and betrayed. I was here on a serious charge, a homicide by whatever name, destruction of life under whatever bureaucratic label, and this was where I belonged, confined upstate. But the people who put me here were trifling with my mind. October 22, 1962. The club was in West Hollywood, called the Troubadour, and the man walked onto the stage and unscrewed the mic from the stand and waved it over the crowd, blessing them. And maybe they felt they needed a benediction, tonight of all nights, because the president had addressed the nation about 6 hours earlier, 4 o'clock Pacific time, on a matter of the highest national urgency. The man looked into the audience, stroking his chin, body set in a hipster slouch. And he wore a charcoal suit, continental cut, with natural shoulders and half lapels, and a dark, slim knit tie, and that New York Levantine look. Yes, this was the infamous sick comic Lenny Bruce. And they waited for him to tell them how they felt. Because the Russians had put missiles into Cuba, and President Kennedy's grim speech still formed a kind of auditory wall running through the room. Nuclear strike capability. Full retaliatory response. Such resonant and carefully crafted terms. This was an audience accustomed to a different level of dread. Out-of-work actors and musicians. Screenwriters doing draft number 92. There were agents with eczema. Wholesome blonde beach-body hookers with their vicious slithering pimps. And Lenny's wearing a little smirk, eyeing this group like he sees right to the tacky nougat center of their collective soul. Always a few literate junkies. Maybe a couple of beehived tourists who'd wandered in by mistake with their siding salesman husbands. And there has to be one name actor with a dose of clap, and another who's been reduced to doing soaps. And they all needed Lenny to help them make the transition to the total global thing that's going on out there, with SAC bombers rumbling over the tarmac and Polaris subs putting to sea, like dive, dive, dive. It's dialogue from every submarine movie ever made, and it's all factually happening. But at the same time, they find it remarkably unreal. Titans and Atlases being readied for firing. Lenny studies them a while, letting the moment draw meaning and portent. It's not at all obvious what he's going to say until he says it, with a thrust to his lower lip and an executive timbre in his voice. Good evening, my fellow citizens. And once he says it, the remark is retroactively inevitable, because this was the president's opening line, of course. And it gets a medium laugh, but Lenny kills the bit before it begins. He's not about to do a Kennedy imitation. He leaned back to distance himself further from the line. Smoke rose from the crowd, hanging in the beam of the baby spot. And he shifted into his own voice, with its bent vowels and high nasal shadings. I dig it on one level. Being on the brink, it's a rush, man. You can talk all you want about living on the edge. Yeah, I know, you smoke some grass on Saturday night, making the scene. Plus you accidentally drove through Watts one night and can't stop talking about it. Made your short hair stand on end. Negroes in pork pie hats. No, yes, this thing here, let me tell you what the edge is. The true edge is not where you choose to live, but where they situate you against your will. This event is infinitely deeper and more electrifying than anything you might elect to do with your own life. You know what this is? This is 26 guys from Harvard deciding our fate. He swiveled toward the wings and pointed at some shadow presence as a laugh bubble broke over the mastheads. Dig it! These are the guys from the eating clubs and the secret societies. They have fraternity handshakes so complicated it takes 3 full minutes to do all the moves. One missed digit, you're fucked for life. Resign from the country club, forget about the stock options and the executive retreat, watch your wife disappear in a haze of secret drinking. You have to be hip to stay connected. These guys wear boxer shorts with geometric designs that contain the escape routes they've been assigned when the missiles start flying. Lenny was a handsome guy with dark hair and hooded eyes, and he resembled a pool shark who'd graduated to deeper and sleazier schemes. His brows were set at a cosmopolitan arch that seemed to function as an open challenge to his hustler aspect. If you're dumb enough to believe my scam, that's your problem, schmucko. And he said, picture it, and snapped his fingers, releasing the genie from the bottle. 26 guys in Clark Kent suits getting ready to enter a luxury bunker that's located about half a mile under the White House. And the faggot decorator's doing a last-minute checklist. Let's see, peach walls, stunning. Found the chandelier in a little abbey outside Paris. None of that Statler, Hilton, Dreck in my bomb shelter. and even those in the audience who were familiar with Lenny's habitual scat, the vocal apparatus with its endless shifts and modulations and assumed identities, the release of underground words and tensions, they felt a small medicinal jolt at the pitch of the decorator's voice.
Rugs? Fabulous! The purest Persian slave labor.
Arched windows.
Okay, we're 12 stories underground, but the curtain fabric was irresistible, so just shut up.
Dining table, plantation mahogany, 11 bottles of lemon pledge.
Centerpiece designed it himself, the highlight of his career, a huge mound of crab meat carved in the shape of, they're gonna love this, it's so forceful and moving,
yes, Kennedy and Khrushchev wrestling in the nude, life size.
And Lenny did a knee dip with his swivel, pausing to let the audience develop the image.
All right, I can't stand around admiring. They'll be down any second. The president, the secretary of state, the joint chiefs, this guy, that guy, the guy with the secret codes for nuclear launch. He's a toilet-trained Jew, incidentally, so there won't be any mix-ups. Let's see now, what else? Flatware, he's done. Stemware, he's done. After-dinner mints? Let's see. Do I give them the mocha or the café noir?
He did the opening again, checking the line for style and fit.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
A stir of renewed anticipation. Maybe they wanted him to pursue the presidential thing, but he waved it off again and stood there sort of humming at the hips, doing a little wobble that seemed to get the next thought going. Then he did the shrillest sort of falsetto.
We're all gonna die!
This cracked him up. He bent from the waist, laughing, and seemed to be using the mic as a Geiger counter, waving it over the floorboards.
Dig it! JFK's got this Russian man-bull staring him down. They're pizzle to pizzle. And this is a guy Jack doesn't know how to deal with. What's he supposed to say? I stooped more debutantes than you? This is a coal miner. He's a guy who herded farm animals barefoot for a couple of kopecks. He's been known to stick his fist up a sow's ass to fertilize his vegetable garden. What's Jack supposed to say to him? A secretary gave me a hand job on the White House elevator? This is a guy who craps with the door open on state occasions. He has sex with his bowling trophies.
The seating at the Troubadour consisted mainly of folding chairs, and when enough people laughed, there was a wheezy groan from the slats and hinges. And the audience sat there thinking, how real can the crisis be if we're sitting in a club on Santa Monica Boulevard going, ha, ha, ha?
We're all gonna die!
Lenny loves the post-existential bent of this line. In his giddy shriek, the audience can hear the obliteration of the idea of uniqueness and free choice. They can hear the replacement of human isolation by massive and unvaried ruin. His closest followers laugh the loudest. Their fan-fed vanity is gratified. They're included in Lenny's own incineration. All the Lennies. The persecuted junkie, the anti-hypocrite, the satirist and nose-picker. Lenny the hipster fink. Lenny the ass mechanic, girl-spotting in hotel lobbies. Lenny the vengeance of the Lord.
Powerless. Understand? This is how they remind us of our basic state. They roll out a periodic crisis. Is it horizontal? One great power against the other? Or is it vertical? Is it up and down?
He seemed to lose his line of argument here.
The U.S. is putting up a naval blockade. Fine. Good. Groovy. Do you hear what he said?
And Lenny did his basso head of state.
Any offensive military equipment being shipped to Cuba gets stopped dead in the water by the U.S. fleet.
He jabbed at some imaginary lint on his lapel, signaling a shift, a bit.
And there's this woman sitting out there in Centralia, listening to the speech. She hears maximum peril. She hears abyss of destruction. She has a job dishing out meat patties in the school cafeteria, and she comes home exhausted and turns on the TV, and it's the President of the United States, and he's saying, abyss of destruction. And she sits there, in a cafeteria whites, with her shoes off, picking her feet. Her name is Biddy. She's thinking they preempted Lawrence Welk so this Irish Catholic millionaire can talk about abyss of destruction. Then she thinks, hey, wait. That's a movie title, right? Sure, it's one of those hard-boiled, cynical crime dramas in moody black and white. I saw it with the muscular dystrophy mothers of central Kansas. The speech goes on, and Biddy's trying to register the enormous. And the president says something about swift and extraordinary buildup. Soviet missiles in Cuba. And she thinks he's talking about the grease in her oven. Yeah, that greasy buildup's beginning to bug me, man. She has this oven cleaner she's eager to try. Works 52% faster than the strongest industrial acid. She tries to concentrate on the president's speech, but everything he's saying sounds like a pitch for insect repellent or throat spray. And Biddy's sitting there, in Emporia or Centralia, and she gets up out of the chair and goes to the phone and calls her friend, Deanne. Deanne is the local movie expert. Deanne reviews movies for the cafeteria workers' newsletter, Meet Patty Week. And Biddy says into the phone, "Who was in that movie the president's talking about on TV?" And Deanne says, "You're asking me about movies at a time like this?" Lenny bent his knees and spread both arms wide, his mouth stretched in a rictus of gaped and grinning terror. "We're all gonna die!" He loved this line so much it was a little unnerving, especially in Deanne's voice, which could shatter a urinal at 50 feet. An hour later, after all the bits, the scatological asides, the improvised voices, it was this isolated line that stayed in people's mind when they went to their cars and drove home to Westwood or Brentwood or wherever, or roamed the freeways for half the night because they knew they wouldn't be able to sleep. And what better place to imagine the flash and burst? Where else would they go to rehearse the end of history or actually see it? This was the meaning of the freeways, and always had been. And they'd always known it at some unsounded level. And so they drove half the night, at first morose, and then angry, and then fatalistic, and then plain shaking scared, chests tight with the knowledge of how little it would take to make the thing happen. The first night on Earth when the unthinkable crept up over the horizon line and waited in an animal squat. And all the time they drove, they heard the keening of that indisguisable Jewish voice repeating the line that had made them bust their guts laughing, astonishingly, only a few hours earlier. July 12th, 1953. It was a gesture without a history. You hefted the weapon and pointed it and saw an interested smile fall across his face. But after that, you were in unknown country. The slyest kind of shit-eating grin. But after you forced back the trigger. The trigger pull was heavy and rough, and after you force-squeezed the trigger, you were in another place, absorbing the noise and movement, the gesture, the way he jerked and fell. Although jerked isn't an adequate word, it was a movement beyond your competence as a witness to understand and describe. At Stottsburg, they had the woman in the office, Dr. Lindblad, and I had regular appointments. Knock, knock. And she probed the subject of the shooting while I tried to get a look at her legs. Forget for a minute that you're the one who shot him. You can't describe the movement properly because it was a level of reality you hadn't rehearsed, either one of you. The unhinged fling of an arm, the right arm whippy and haywire, like a part that runs amok in a machine. And the whole body spasm, an arrhythmic thing, a thing outside the limits of experience. You don't want to forget he was sitting in a chair. The chair moved not unlike the man. The chair could have been a version of the man, so drastic was its tumble into the wall. And of course your own shock, the trauma of perception. How can you tell what's going on if you're in shock yourself? Dr. Lindblad said, "Do you think you'd like to have a family someday?" "I don't know. Haven't thought about it." "No," I said. "I don't think so. Kids? I don't want kids. I don't want to be a father." "And why is that?" "Why is that? I don't know. After what I've done, I don't think I should be a father, do you?" "What have you done, Nick?" I smiled at her.
I liked Dr. Lindblad. She wasn't good-looking, but she was stacked. The alley boys liked her, the gang members, because she listened to their stories without making judgments. She did delicate twirling tricks with their rage and shame and sullen excuses. She didn't try to get them to moderate their sense of inevitability. They were at war with society, and what's the point of pretending otherwise? I didn't tell her anything, but I liked going into her office and smelling the furniture wax and checking the titles of the books and scouting out the bulge of her breasts under the fabric of whatever snug blouse she was wearing that day. One of the alley boys looked out the window of the mess and said, "That's a Disney picture, man." He was talking about the miniature golf course. "And we're the dwarfs that's supposed to be in it." I wanted my correction to be consistent and strong. They'd made an attempt to try me as an adult, even though I was only 17 at the time, and I agreed with their reasoning, that there was a cold-blooded element in this crime, whatever the shadings. When a judge ruled that the prosecution couldn't do this, they decided to try me for manslaughter. And again, I thought, why not, considering the recklessness of the act? But my lawyer, Imperato, a man with sallow jowls and a briefcase that was shedding skin, arranged a plea deal, and they went for a lesser charge. And now I stood looking at the golf course on a soft summer morning, a few days before my release, and saw that someone had painted names all over the ramparts and windmills, the nicknames of gang members, "All Hail the Alhambras." And the guys gawked and pointed and bent over laughing. And I thought this was the time to start my round of guilty goodbyes. "Because you were the shooter and the witness both, and you can separate these roles. The second was helpless to prevent the first from acting. The second could not stop the act, could not manage it, and finally didn't know how to perceive it. It was too down deep, even as it reached his eyes, your eyes. The terrible spasticky thing, the whole groan-like abandon, the resignation of life and breath to this vehement depth of gesture, man and chair going different ways." Dr. Lindblad might have said, "The gesture is extreme because the mind is closing down. It's the end of consciousness. So the body goes berserk. The body shows you what's happening to the mind. The way a person's grief bends the body. This is how consciousness looks. This is how it flails and thrashes when the end is sudden and violent and the mind is unprepared." And I might have said, "You're talking about his mind? How the end is sudden? Or mine?" But she didn't say it, and I didn't say it, because I wasn't talking much. The alley boys were talking. They told her they were in a state of total war with society. They told her it would be that way until they were dead. Society wanted them dead. The alley boys were too smart not to know this. They told her they'd get released and go back to the street, which was another department of the penal system, and vice versa. And they'd go back and do what they'd always done, they told her. They'd deal, steal, get the edge, carry the peace, and pursue the conduct of the war. The book fits the hand. It fits the individual. The way you hold a book and turn the pages, hand and eye, the rote motions of raking gravel on a hot country road, the marks on the page, the way one page is like the next but also totally different, the lives in books, the hills going green, old rolling hills that made you feel you were becoming someone else. Dr. Lindblad tried to work my soul. She believed in my salvation. She probed all the forces in my history, and she gave me books to read, and I read them. And she advanced ideas about what had happened, and I thought about them. But I didn't know if I accepted the idea that I had a history. She used that word a lot, and it was hard for me to imagine that all the scuffle and boredom of those years, the crisscross boredom and good times and flare-ups and same-shit nights, I didn't understand how the streaky blur in my nighttime mind could have some sort of form and coherence. Maybe there was a history in her files, but the thing I felt about myself was that I'd leaned against a wall in a narrow street, serving out some years of mostly aimless waiting. But you felt some things, didn't you? You felt the strange fascination of his dying fall. So crazy-armed and unmade up that you didn't know how to look at it. She told me that my father was the third person in the room the day I shot George Monza. This was frankly news to me, and I sort of half-laughed. You know, the way you snicker a nervous draft of air down your nostrils. She told me that one way or another the two events were connected, meaning that 6 years after Jimmy disappeared, I shot a guy who didn't know my father, or barely knew him, or saw him on the street a few times, and this was a link she wanted to probe. "You have a history," she said, "that you are responsible to." "What do you mean by responsible to?" "You're responsible to it. You're answerable. You're required to try to make sense of it. You owe it your complete attention." She kept talking about history in her tight blouse. But all I saw was the crazy armed man. His body spinning one way, the chair going another. And all I saw was the rough slur of those narrow streets, the streets going narrower all the time, collapsing in on themselves, and the dumb, sad sameness of the days. Then they came and told me I'd be getting an early release, unexpectedly, one summer day. I wasn't sure how I felt about this. They told me they were sending me to the Jesuits, at the wintry end of the world, somewhere near a lake in Minnesota. Chapter 2. October 8th, 1957. The Demings were home this afternoon, busy at various tasks in their split-level suburban house. A long, low, two-tone colonial with a picture window, a breezeway, and bright siding. Erica was in the kitchen making jello chicken mousse for dinner. 3 cups chicken broth, or 3 chicken bouillon cubes, dissolved in 3 cups boiling water. 2 packages jello lemon gelatin. 1 teaspoon salt. 1/8 teaspoon cayenne. 3 tablespoons vinegar. 1 1/3 cups whipped topping mix. 2/3 cup mayonnaise. 2 cups finely diced cooked chicken. 2 cups finely chopped celery. 2 tablespoons chopped pimento. Then boil and pour and stir and blend. Fold spiced and chilled gelatin into chicken thing. Spoon into 9x5-inch loaf pan, chill until firm, unmold, garnish with crisp lettuce and stuffed olives, if desired. Makes 6 entree salads. Do not reuse this bottle for storing liquids. Erica did things with Jell-O that took people's breath away. Even now, as she prepared the chicken mousse for final chilling, there were 9 parfait glasses and the 2-tone Kelvinator. This was dessert for the next 3 evenings. Each glass was tilted at a 45-degree angle, either against the wall of the refrigerator or against another object. This tilting method, handed down from her grandmother and her mother, allowed Erica to do Jell-O desserts in a number of colorful diagonal stripes, working the combinations among 6 flavors. She might put black raspberry Jell-O, slightly thickened, into a parfait glass. She puts the glass in the fridge, tilting it at 45 degrees. After the gelatin chills and fully thickens, she folds in a swath of lime Jell-O, and then maybe orange, and then strawberry or strawberry banana. At the end of the process, she has 9 multi-striped desserts, all different, all so vividly attractive. Doing things with Jell-O was just about the best way to improve her mood, which was oddly gloomy today. She couldn't figure out why. From the kitchen window, she could see the lawn, neat and trimmed, low-hedged, open and approachable. The trees at the edge of the lawn were new, like everything else in the area. All up and down the curving streets, there were young trees and small new box shrubs, and a sense of openness, a sense of seeing everything there is to see at a single glance, with nothing shrouded or walled or protected from the glare. Nothing shrouded or secret, except for young Eric, who sat in his room behind drawn fiberglass curtains, jerking off into a condom. He liked using a condom because it had a sleek, metallic shimmer, like his favorite weapon system, the Honest John, a surface-to-surface missile with a warhead that carried yields of up to 40 kilotons. Avoid contact with eyes, open cuts, or running sores. He sat sprawled in a butterfly chair and thought nobody could ever guess what he was doing, especially the condom part. Nobody could ever guess it, know it, imagine it, or associate him with it. But what happens, he thought, if you die someday? And it turns out that everything you've ever done in private becomes general knowledge in the hereafter. Everybody automatically knows everything you ever did when you thought you were totally and sneakingly and safely unseen. Prolonged exposure to sun may cause bursting. They put thermal pads on the Honest John to heat the solid fuel in preparation for firing. Then they remove the pads and launch the missile from a girder-like launch rail in a grassy field somewhere in the free world. And the missile's infallible flight, the way it sweeps out precise volumes of mathematical space, it's so saintly and sun-tipped, swinging out of its apex to dive to Earth. And the way the fireball halos out above its column of smoke and roar, like some nameless, faceless whatever. It made him want to be a Catholic. Plus, she'd have 3 chicken mousse salads for leftovers later in the week. Out on the breezeway, husband Rick was simonizing their 2-tone Ford Fairlane convertible. Brand new, like the houses and the trees, with white wall tires and stripes of jet-streak chrome that fairly crackled when the car was in motion. Erica kept her jello molds in the seashell beige cabinet over the range. She had fluted molds, ring molds, crown molds in a number of sizes. She had notes and diagrams, mold techniques, offer forms for special decorative molds that she intended to fill out and mail at her earliest convenience. If swallowed, induce vomiting at once. Eric stroked his dick in a conscientious manner, somber and methodical. The condom was feely in a way he'd had to get used to, rubbery, dumb, and disaffecting. On the floor between his feet was a photo of Jane Mansfield, with her knockers coming out of a sequined gown. He wanted to sandwich his dick between her breasts until it went, whee! But he wouldn't just walk out of the door when it was over. He would talk to her breasts, be tender and lovey, tell them what his longings were, his hopes and dreams. There was one mold Erica had never used, sort of guided missile-like, because it made her feel uneasy somehow. The face in the picture was all painted mouth and smudgy lashes, and at a certain point in the furtherance of his business, Eric deflected his attention from the swooping breasts and focused on the facial Jane, on her eyebrows and lashes and puckered lips. The breasts were real. The face was put together out of 1,000 thermoplastic things. And in the evolving scan of his Eros, it was the masking waxes, liners, glosses, and creams that became the soft, moist mechanisms of release. Intentional misuse by deliberately inhaling contents can be harmful or fatal. Erica wore a swirly blue skirt and buttercup blouse that happened to match the colors of their Fairlane. Rick was still on the breezeway, running a chamois over the chromework. This was something, basically, he could do forever. He could look at himself in a strip of chrome, warp-eyed and hydrocephalic, and feel some of the power of the automobile. The horsepower, the decibel rumble of dual exhausts, the pedal tension of Ford-O-Matic drive. The sneaky thing about this car was that, yes, you drove it sensibly to the dentist and occasionally carpooled with the Andersons and took Eric to the science fair, but beneath the routine family applications was the crouched power of the machine, top-down, eating up the landscape. Danger, contents under pressure. One of Erica's favorite words in the language was breezeway. It spoke of ease and breeze and being contemporary and having something others did not. Another word she loved was crisper. The Kelvinator had a nice roomy crisper, and she liked to tell the men that such and such was in the crisper, not the refrigerator, the crisper, The carrots are in the crisper, Rick. There were people out there on the old farm road, where the front porches sag badly and the grass goes unmowed, and the Duck River Baptists worship in a squat building that sits in the weeds on the way to the dump, who didn't know what a crisper was, who had ice boxes instead of refrigerators, or who had refrigerators that lacked crispers, or who had crispers in their refrigerators but didn't know what they were for or what they were called, who put tubs of butter in the crisper instead of lettuce, or eggs instead of carrots. He came in from the breezeway. The carrots are in the crisper, Rick. He liked to nibble on a raw carrot after he'd waxed and buffed the car. He stood looking at the strontium white loaf that sat on a bed of lettuce inside a cake pan in the middle of the table. Woof! What is it? It's my Jell-O chicken mousse. Hey, great, he said. Sometimes she called it her Jell-O chicken mousse, and sometimes she called it her chicken mousse Jell-O. This was one of a thousand convenient things about Jell-O. The word went anywhere, front or back or in the middle. It was a push-button word, the way so many things were push-button now, the way the whole world opened behind a button that you pushed. May cause discoloration of urine or feces. Eric sidled along the wall and slipped into the bathroom, palming the sloppy condom. He washed it out on the sink and then fitted it over his middle finger and aimed the finger at his mouth so he could blow the condom dry. And in the movie version of his life, he imagined how everything is projected on a cinemascope screen, all the secret things he did alone over the years. And now that he is dead, it's all available for public viewing, and all his dead relatives and friends and teachers and ministers can watch him with his finger in his mouth, more or less, and a condom on his finger, and he is panting rhythmically to dry it off. He heard his mother call his name. He had to wash it and reuse it because this was the only one he had, borrowed from another boy, Danny Anderson, who'd taken it from his father's hiding place under the bald socks, and who swore he'd never used it himself. A thing that wouldn't be fully established until both boys were dead and Eric had a chance to see the footage. To avoid suffocation, keep out of reach of small children. Eric hid the rubber in his room, pressed into a box of playing cards. He took a long look at Jane Mansfield's picture before he slipped it into the world atlas on his desk. He realized that Jane's breasts were not as real-looking as he'd thought in his emotionally vulnerable state, dick in hand. They reminded him of something, but what? And then he saw it, the bumper bullets on a Cadillac. He went into the kitchen and opened the fridge just to see what was going on in there. The bright colors, the product names and logos, the array of familiar shapes, the tinsel glitter of things in foil wrap, the general sense of benevolent gleam, of eyeball surprise, the sense of a tiny holiday taking place on the shelves and in the slots, a world unspoiled and ever-renewable. But there was something else as well, faintly unnerving. The throb, perhaps. Maybe it was the informational flow contained in that endless motorized throb. Open the great white vault-like door and feel the cool breezelet of systems at work, converting current into power, talking to each other day and night across superhuman spaces, a thing he felt outside of, not yet attuned to, and it confused him just a bit. Except their Kelvinator wasn't white, of course, not on the outside anyway. It was cameo rose and pearly dawn. He looked inside. He saw the 9 tilted parfait glasses and felt a little dizzy. He got disoriented sometimes by the tilted Jell-O desserts. It was as if a science fiction force had entered the house and made some things askew while sparing others. They sat down to dinner, and Rick carved the mousse and doled out portions. They drank iced tea with a slice of lemon wedged to the rim of each glass, one of Erica's effortless extra touches. Rick said to Eric, "What you been up to all afternoon? Big homework day?"
"Hey, Dad, saw you Simonizing the car."
"Got an idea. After dinner, we'll take the binoculars and drive out on the old farm road and see if we can spot it.
Spot what? Erica said.
The baby moon. What else? The satellite they put up there. Supposed to be visible on clear nights.
It wasn't until this moment that Erica understood why her day had felt shadowed and ominous from the time she opened her eyes and stared at the Mikado yellow walls with patina green fleecing. Yes, that satellite they put into orbit a few days ago. Rick took a scientific interest and wanted Eric to do the same. Sure, Rick was surprised and upset, just as she was, but he was willing to stand in a meadow somewhere and try to spot the object as it floated over. Erica felt a twisted sort of disappointment. It was theirs, not ours. It flew at an amazing rate of speed over the North Pole. Beep, beep, beep. Passing just above us, evidently, at certain times. She couldn't understand how this could happen. Were there other surprises coming? Things we haven't been told about them? Did they have CRISPRs and breezeways? It was not a simple matter, adjusting to the news. Rick said, "What about it, Eric? Want to drive on out?"
"Hey, Dad. Great."
A pall fell over the table, displacing Erica's Sputnik funk. She thought Eric's occasional stuttering had something to do with the time he spent alone in his room.
"Hitting the books too hard," Rick thought.
He was hitting something too hard, but Erica tried not to form detailed images.
"Do not puncture or incinerate."
The boy could sit in the family room and watch their super console TV, which was compatible with the knotty pine paneling, and he could anticipate the dialogue on every show. Newscasts, ball games, comedy hours. He did whatever voice the announcer or actor used, matching the words nearly seamlessly, and he never stuttered. All the other kids ate Oreo cookies. Eric ate Hydrox cookies, because the name sounded like rocket fuel. One of her kitchen gloves was missing. She had many pairs, and she wanted to believe Eric had borrowed it for one of his chemistry assignments, but she was afraid to ask. And she didn't think she looked forward to getting it back. Yesterday he dunked a Hydrox cookie in milk, held it dripping over the glass, and said thickly,
"It's very good. We put Russian moon in U.S. sky."
Then he took a bite and swallowed. The men went out to find the orbiting satellite. Erica cleared the table, put on her rubberoid gloves, and began to do the dishes. Rick had kidded her about the gloves a number of times. The kitchen was equipped with an automatic dishwasher, of course, but she felt compelled, as a homemaker, to do a preliminary round of hand-washing and scouring, because if you don't get every smidge of organic murk off the fork tines and out of the pans before you run the dishwasher, it could come back to haunt you in the morning. Flush eyes with water and call physician at once. And the gloves protected her from scalding water and the touch of food scraps. Erica loved her gloves. The gloves were indestructible, basically, made of the same kind of materials used in countertops and TV tubes, in the electrical insulation in the basement, and the vulcanized tires on the car. The gloves were important to her, despite the way they felt, clammy but also dry. A feeling that defied innate contradiction. All the things around her were important. Things and words. Words to believe in and live by. Breezeway. CRISPR. Sectional. Carpools. Bridge parties. Broadloom. When she finished up in the kitchen, she decided to vacuum the living room rug, but then realized this would make her bad mood worse. She'd recently bought a new satellite-shaped vacuum cleaner that she loved to push across the room because it hummed softly and seemed futuristic and hopeful. But she was forced to regard it ruefully now, after Sputnik, a clunky object filled with self-remorse. Stacking chairs, scatter cushions, storage walls, room divider, fruit juicer. Cookie sheet. She thought she'd lift her spirits by doing something for the church social on Saturday, to pep up the event a little. Do not use an enclosed space. She would prepare half a dozen serving bowls of her Jell-O antipasto salad. 6 packages Jell-O lemon gelatin, 6 teaspoons salt, 6 cups boiling water, 6 tablespoons vinegar, 12 cups ice cubes, 3 cups finely cut salami, 2 cups finely cut Swiss cheese, 1.5 cups chopped celery, 1.5 cups chopped onion, 12 tablespoons sliced ripe olives. She remembered coming home one day about 6 months ago and finding Eric with his head in a bowl of her antipasto salad. He said he was trying to eat it from the inside out to test a scientific theory of his. The explanation was so crazy and unconvincing that it was weirdly believable. But she didn't believe it. She didn't know what to believe. Was this a form of sexual curiosity? Was he pretending the Jell-O was a sort of lickable female body part? And was he engaged in an act of unnatural oral stimulation? He had Jell-ified gunk all over his mouth and tongue. She looked at him. She had people skills. Erica was a person who related to people. But she had to put on gloves just to talk to him. She set to work in the kitchen now, listening all the while for the reassuring sound of her men coming home, car doors closing in the breezeway, the solid clunk of well-made parts swinging firmly shut.
This ends Disc 17.